Well, good morning, students. Let's get back into the book of Job. If we recall from our last time, the book has three large sections. It begins with prose, then moves into many, many chapters of poetry, and finally ends with a short section of prose. And so the prose sections are really like little stories, are they not? And the poetry is rich in dialogue and deep in emotion. In the poetry part, we have three friends, Eliphaz, Zophar, and Bildad, who are arguing in a cyclical pattern with Job, and it goes through three cycles of conversation, until finally, Job is the last one speaking. At a certain point, he accuses God of having wronged him, and then God, then Elihu, speaks, the young man who has been holding his tongue out of deference to age. And this is an interesting thing for you who are young. It says there that wisdom does not always belong to the aged. And so I think it's right that he recognizes his age and lets the older man go first. But part of the irony of this is that the young man actually is speaking on behalf of God. And the young man then, his speech slides into God's speech, as Elihu's speaking about the storm coming, introduces God, kind of like the way I describe it to students, like Ed McMahon used to introduce Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. That's more farcical, and this is deathly serious. So, in the midst of all this, on top of those cycles of conversation and how it ends with Jehovah or Yahweh speaking from the storm in two parts. In the middle of all that is chapter 28, which is called by Raymond Scheinland, The Meditation on Wisdom. We're going to come back to that important chapter a little bit later because it provides a key for answering Scheinland's argument. Now let's talk about Raymond Scheinland then for a second. If you recall, we're using his book as a poem in English to give you the sense of the beauty of the poem in Hebrew. But I've now asked you to read the introduction to the book that describes not just his translation theory, but his understanding of the literary message of the book, what the book is trying to do. He calls it a work of consolation. It's trying to comfort us in a particular way. And so if we were in class together, I would ask you a couple questions to kind of get at what Scheinland's saying. Number one, what is the purpose of the prose? Number two, what is the purpose of the poetry? Number three, why is there both? And then number four, how is it that the combination is comforting? So let's examine those four questions then one by one together. Number one, why is there prose? Now, if you have read the introduction to Scheinland's book, you will understand that his take on this piece of literature is that the storyline existed first. This is speaking about Job the patient, which is a classical description of Job, as well as a biblical one, as James chapter 5 speaks about the patience of Job. It's become a proverb when somebody is very patient, and Scheinland is saying that it's as if mothers in Israel used to look at their children who would complain about, you know, a scrape on their knee or something they didn't get, and then say, let me tell you a story about a man that lost something. And let me tell you about a story of a man that really got hurt. And then they would tell the story of Job and how Job responded in such calm manner towards God. You know, blessed be the name of the Lord. He gives, he takes away. As he says in chapter 2 to his wife, shall we expect good from God and not accept adversity? And in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. And then you see Johnny, or he might say something like, you see Boaz, why aren't you patient like Job? And so it was passed on as just kind of this little story, maybe from generation to generation, as as a pious reminder from conventional wisdom of how to respond to God with great patience. Well, the poetry acts in a very different manner, doesn't it? And Scheinlin calls the Job of the poetry Everyman Job. This is Job the Everyman. He represents us. That first Job is plastic. Nobody can relate to him. I mean, who's going to respond that way? Ah, but this Job Everyman, he speaks our language. He's voicing our deep sorrow, even our rage and our anger. And so in the poetry of the section, we find the richness of imagination and the richness of expression that gives voice then to our own pain. It comforts us, Scheinlin says, in two ways. Number one, in the multitudinousness of the details that it gives. It distracts by going through all the things of life in its richness. So in this way, poetry does what poetry does best. The imagery, the feels, all those sights and sounds come crashing into our imagination as the poetry just lavishes itself upon us. And in doing so, then it kind of lifts us, or you might even say pushes us out of our sorrow into rejoicing again in God's, in the great planet, right? In the skies and the animals and all that the book ends with. It also comforts us, according to Scheinlin, by giving voice to our rage. What it does not do, though, is comfort us with logic or with what he calls theology, a form of logic trying to understand rationally and with reason, the reason of our mind, what God is actually doing in all of this pain. So that's what the poetry is there for, and that's why it's so long. It has to be long to distract as well as to give adequate voice to our rage. And this is why then Job Everyman. Now why is there both? Why not just have the poetry so that we can just rage and or be distracted and be comforted in that way? Why do you need that first part that Scheinlin looks down on? Well, there's several words that he uses in his introduction to describe the relationship between the two. One is irony. Our postmodern world uses a lot of irony. A lot of our humor is irony. You know, we kind of roll our eyes and go, "That's the best tasting meal I've ever had." And it's saying the exact opposite, right? And so when we're saying the opposite, and especially in a knowing crowd, we're saying the opposite, but the person himself doesn't know it. There's kind of an insider joke going on. It can be very mean in that sense, but we, as the readers, are being included in to this kind of secret society or this joke on the pious conventional wisdom that says God is just and there's always reward to those who are righteous. And this, what he says here, is that the poetry mocks the prose. The poetry has irony in its saying the exact opposite that the prose is saying. It satirizes it. It's a satire. And so in it's mocking, it's presenting a paradox. All of this language is from the beginning of his introduction. And so not only does the form change, not only does Job change, it's a different Job, but he's saying the real meaning of the book as a whole is in the way the poetry mocks the prose, as if, and when the prose says there's a meaning to God and everybody lives happily ever after in the end, as Job gets everything back twice as much. And the poetry goes, "Yeah, right," and mocks it. So that's the tense relationship between the two. It's satire and it's irony. It's making a joke of the claim that God is just. So that brings us then to Scheinlin's theodicy. If we were to ask the two questions that we ended last time, so with regard to suffering, is there a reason for the suffering I'm experiencing? That's the first question. And then the second question is, if there is a reason, can I know it? And both of these questions regarding suffering and knowledge are addressed by Scheinlin in what, not just his personal theology, in some sense, you know, we might not know his personal theology, but in what he claims that the book's theology as a piece of literature is doing. He is claiming something about suffering and something about knowledge is being said through this book. So let's do the first. Suffering. What does Scheinlin say the book of Job is claiming about suffering? This is going to be found in the introduction on page 15, where Scheinlin says that this key fact should be kept in mind when the entire poem is being read, that Job is right, I'm quoting now, in maintaining steadfastly throughout the book that his suffering is unjust, and that his friends are wrong in maintaining that God is always just and that Job therefore must have sinned. So Job is right in maintaining that suffering, his suffering in particular, is unjust. On the next page it says that God manages his universe in an arbitrary fashion. God's management of the universe is arbitrary, that Job was right when he asserted that the good and the guilty he destroys alike. Now you can see he's quoting from Job's sorrowful statement in chapter 9 that God treats the good and the guilty alike, which we know from some of the other prophets, say Malachi, the last book of the Bible, is going to question that and say that's the way the wicked talk. It's interesting, even Elihu comes back at the end of the book and reproves Job's accusation at this point as if there is injustice with God. So here we have this, the pessimism then coming through that God is acting capriciously, God is acting arbitrarily, and that in that sense, it would be vain to go looking for a just reason within the Almighty. Well, because of that difficult truth being asserted and that our sufferings do not need to make sense, we're not going to be surprised then that Scheinlin also asserts that it cannot be known. On page 16, he says that Yahweh, which is the Hebrew name for God, now it's just four letters in the Hebrew, we'll talk about that later. We think this may be the vowel pronunciation of it, but Yahweh, he says, is outside human calculations of justice. Man cannot know whether his suffering has any meaning at all, and it is impertinent of him to ask. So there's no reason, just reason behind the suffering, and there is then no knowledge. In fact, it would be impertinent for man to ask. Now, what is the proof that Scheinlin gives for his take on Job? Well, with regard to the suffering having no reason, he has three things that are proof. Number one, it's the structure of the book. He points to the fact that you have this story that's been kind of split open and a big poetry section sandwiched in, and the dichotomy between the two, in fact, the polar opposite nature of these two kinds of literature then points to satire, irony, and such. Number two, you heard it twice there. At the end of the book, Yahweh commends Job. The Lord commends Job for being in the right and asks him to pray for his friends who have been in the wrong. God's angry with Job's three friends. Job has been in the right. And Scheinlin is saying, look, see, that's the climax of the book. Job was right all along. God is unjust. And then number three, the form, the poetry itself, he claims in the introduction on page 41, is the message of the book. In other words, not just what the poetry in its words is saying, but the poetry as a form of communication is saying. Now this is going to be important concept for you to grasp. You need to recognize, so pay attention. For Scheinlin, poetry itself is by its nature not rational. There's several quotes in his book that points in this direction. On page 37, probably one of the best ones is one, but let me go back first of all to page 25. As well as page 23. On page 23, he says that we are given in the book of Job a discussion that renders meaningless the consolations of conventional piety, traditional wisdom, and theology. Notice the dichotomy here. In their place, it offers a poem. So, a poem is going to be opposite to theology, which he defines as a species of logic. Two pages later, page 25, he says, poetry is used to shift the ground from reason, where life must lose, to emotion, where it at least has a chance. This is going to be what he calls later the power of poetry. We don't go to poetry to gain information. Instead, we go to poetry so that the poet's imagination can work on us. You see how reason and information is not a part of poetry. It shifts the ground from reason then to emotion. It's on the ground of emotion that life has a chance. Last quote, page 37, with regard to the meditation on wisdom, which he does not regard as being legitimate, and I think he even thinks of it as being inserted in the book. He says that the meditation on wisdom falters because it bluntly states a concrete message. While the author of Job has struggled for 42 chapters to replace all messages with poetry. See, poetry is the opposite of messages. He says the literary form of the meditation derives from the certainties of wisdom literature, while the rest of the book is grounded in the ambiguities and conflict characteristic of real poetry. So yeah, on the surface, the Meditation of Wisdom, chapter 28, looks like poetry. Okay, it's poetry, but it's not real poetry. This is fake poetry. It's fake because it has certainties and reflects that conventional wisdom that the rest of the book is mocking. Real poetry is ambiguous and has tension and is filled with irrational emotion. It's the opposite then of a concrete message. So I hope you can see at this point we are dealing with a true fact value split in Scheinlin's introduction. If we could describe it on the one hand with regard to the facts, that's the realm of logic and of reason and concrete things where messages are possible. On the other hand, we have the realm of value, which is where the poetry is. And so that's where emotion and the ambiguities and the tensions of life, and there's never any rational resolution to these things. Prose gives us reason. Poetry gives us emotion. And the two do not come together. That's why we call it a fact value split. And this is actually typical of a theological approach a certain theological approach to understanding a knowledge of God. I remember when I was troubled in my later 20s, and I went through good 3 years of doubt. And the reason was that I had relied so much upon my mathematical training. I thought I had been given the tools of logic, and with the confidence of a positivist, I attacked the Bible and became kind of the studier of the Bible, thinking that I'm going to bring out of it all these philosophical propositions and then arrange them in a logical fashion and build this huge Tower of Babel of theology to God. And predictably, it crashed. It was like a house of cards. It crashed all around me, and I didn't know where to place my feet, what was certain ground to stand on. And in those days of uncertainty, I remember actually toying with the idea that those after the Enlightenment who have experienced the same thing as I did, of the failure of reason to understand God, many have toyed with and some have adopted that theology at the end of the day is just going to be poetry. In other words, we're going to ditch the kind of Greek-style philosophical approach to theology, taking their stance on it, and we're going to adopt a religious experience approach to theology that is best captured with poetry. And in that sense, it's going to mimic the romantic reaction, the reaction of romanticism to the rationalism of the Enlightenment. And many of the romantic poets were very religious. Samuel Taylor Coleridge being a great example of that. And so here we have then a legacy of that time period. And so how should we think about this? What would we say in response? While we can recognize that this has been a tempting option in modern times, and we can actually sympathize with the cause of it historically, is it our only option? Are we left with just a dichotomy at the end of the day in a way that we can't bring the two parts of the book together into a cohesive whole that doesn't end up relying on tension, irony, and satire? Well, first of all, let's give some thoughts regarding the literary structure of the book, and then some thoughts about the theodicy, the claims that are being made by Scheinlin and the message of the book. Number one, Scheinlin seems to assume that a typical approach, a liberal approach to the Old Testament, that the Old Testament is the product of oral tradition, of stories being passed on word of mouth, generation to generation, and then these stories then were captured at some point and put down to writing. We're going to learn in a couple weeks, Lord willing, that it's actually the opposite in the ancient Near East, both in Mesopotamia and Egypt. Stories were written down and then were taught by recitation and passed and given orally on the basis of a stable written text. And so when that kind of picture is presented, to say that the poetry was later inserted into a prose story would beg the question, where did the prose story come from? And so you might say, well, there's a prose story that was written down and then a poetry story was inserted later. That is possible. And all things in that sense are possible. I just want you to know we would have no documentary proof of that. And so with a lot of claims made about the kind of generation of the Old Testament books, that it started this way and then was built this way, it is possible to have editorial additions, like in, say, Proverbs 25 and following, which the men of Hezekiah, a couple centuries after Solomon, apparently added to the book that had initially existed, kind of like in a second edition came out. At least that's the way it appears is possible there and probably likely. We don't have here any indication in the text of two authors, nor do we have any sources in Hebrew manuscripts that would have two authors. In other words, we don't have chapters 1 and 2 and 42 as a manuscript by itself. It would be dangerous, secondly, it would be dangerous to assert from the mere form of the literature different authorships. Can you imagine if I did that with C.S. Lewis, a man of so many talents that could write, academic prose as a literary critic, and then write poetry as he sought in his early years to be a poet above anything else, as well as philosophical essays or even children's literature, as well as very, very tightly written, science fiction prose, as well as an imitation of a Greek myth, Until We Have Faces. If you were to take all the variety of Lewis's genres and then infer different authorships, the way sometimes biblical critics do, like the Apostle John, comparing the book of Revelation to, say, the Gospel of John, we would end up with obviously a fallacy in the modern era. Oddly enough, we think it's legitimate scholarship to do it, or criticism to do it in the past. Again, it might be, but we need to be cautious about drawing those inferences. Number three, we need to be cautious about inferring that there's more than one Job. We talked about last time how Shane and Shane, with their song "Though He Slay Me," spoken about their mother and the loss of their father, and how Mom reacted in the same way Job did in chapter 1. But perhaps 2 months later, if we were to look at, Mrs. Shane, we would be recognizing there's anger. She's calling out to the heavens, why? Her initial response in the shock of the moment is to draw near and just in sheer passivity and collapsedness to just say God is God and he did what he did and blessed be his name. But as we saw, after 7 days of silence, and Job begins to question God out of the depths of his sorrow in chapter 3, psychologists will tell us that there are stages of grief. And after the initial shock, and it starts penetrating, much the same way as touching something very, very hot at first doesn't do much damage if you can immediately put it under cold water. But if you let that initial surface heat be allowed to penetrate into the flesh, it does great damage. That's the way grief works on us. And so I think this is actually very psychologically plausible that Job, after 7 days of silently considering what had just happened to him and how his entire world had been rocked, comes from the depths of his being and comes just a hairbreadth shy of cursing God, which is the wager that Satan had made with God. I think that's plausible. Fourthly, how is it that Job is right? Shylin goes to the end of the book, and I think he's cheating by dipping into the prose at this point. And if you were to sandwich the two prose pieces together, you'd be left with the friends never talking, only 7 days of silence. And so it seems odd. Somehow they need to be together, and maybe he thinks that it was stuck by the author of the poetry into the prose part. But again, it seems illegitimate to base a big part of his argument on the part of the book he thinks is being mocked, the prose, unless he only limits that to the first. But the big question is, even regardless of those things, how is it that Job is right? God does say Job is right. How is Job right? If you go through it, one by one, Elihu says that Job is wrong in chapter 32 and following. And then God says, Job is wrong. And then Job himself says, I've been wrong. He repents and he retracts in dust and ashes. That's the last thing he says in chapter 42, verse 5. I didn't know what I was talking about. I darkened counsel without knowledge. And so, how is it then that God comes to the end of the book, after all of that, Job being wrong threefold times, and then says Job is right? In what sense was Job speaking right? And I think it's very possible that it's in the last thing that Job said. Job has just repented. And Job spoke right. That you are a God who can do whatever you want to do. And now Job has the attitude that says, and it's right for you to do whatever you want to do. Not only can you, but you should. And so he's asserted that God is free. God is sovereign, which is the fear of the Lord, which the meditation on wisdom says is wisdom for us, for man, to fear God, to have as the basis of our thinking at its most ground level, that God should be God, that you're God and I'm not, you know and I don't know. And so that attitude, not of a trembling, like panicky, you know, run away, I did something wrong attitude, but more than respect, even more than reverence, it's a deep, deep sense of acknowledgement that the infinite is different than me, the finite, and that that relationship will never change, and that that relationship is right. Finally, I think we need to question Scheinlin's putting down and despising the meditation on wisdom. If you read the book of Job, there's no difference in from chapter 28 to before and after. And I just want you to note, chapter 28 is the only chapter that does not tell us who is speaking. All the other, I believe, poetry chapters or sections tell you who is speaking. And so even though Job is speaking in chapter 27 and in chapter 29, it really does seem like chapter 28 is the author himself speaking. And so even though Scheinlin would not want to claim that the author of the book of Job is speaking right here, he actually is speaking. And he's letting us know, though some may say, well, that's anticlimactic, he's letting us know before Elihu speaks and before God speaks and before even Job rises to his crescendo that there's something really, really wrong going on here, even though we as the readership know Job did nothing to deserve this. In that sense, Job has been right. But the inferences Job is drawing from that fact are going in a direction that is definitely not right, and so chapter 28 tips us off ahead of time. And so in the Hebrew, there's actually nothing there that says it's any different than any of the other chapters. In other words, to deny it being real poetry is to make an arbitrary decision. It begs the question. It's an assertion without grounding, other than his own presuppositions that conventional wisdom and piety is being mocked. I wouldn't call just a mere bland statement that the righteous will prosper the kind of theology that the book is bringing and the book assumes and calls. That theology is short-sighted to some degree, but in some degree it's actually right. The book does end with Job being, as it were, recompensed. And the New Testament brings out the fact that look at the end of Job's life and draw some insight from it. So, here's what we learn then. Based on the fear of the Lord and the way Yahweh speaks and how Job responds, it's more important that we know whom rather than why. In our questioning in the midst of our sufferings, we will cry out why, but it's much more important to know who. What God does to answer Job's pain is not tell him what happened. He gives him no answer, but God gives him himself so that Job can actually say, I've heard about you with the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. The knowledge of God in direct communication, God revealing himself to Job, has given Job a different platform upon which then to gain comfort. Much the same way that a parent with a child doesn't go into lengthy explanations of something a child can't understand anyways, but draws near, holds the child close, and brings the presence and speaks into the child's life, revealing, I am here. Yes, Job needed to be corrected, and so God comes in the storm. But Job never even thought God would speak. God stooped to speak to Job, and in doing so, God showed his desire to draw near and to rescue, though the medicine was difficult, to rescue the servant that he actually esteems and was proud of at the beginning of the book. This leads us into the theodicy. And here I'm going to tick off several thoughts. Please track with me. I'll try not to be too quick, but I'll try not to be too brief either. So here's some thoughts I want you to think about as you write a review of this book, and I'm going to ask you to write a review not on the biblical book, but on the introduction of the book, on Shiland's take on what the book is saying. I want you to keep some things in mind. Number one, we cannot attribute what happened to Job to original sin. In other words, we can't minimize the way Zophar does in his reductionistic fashion that you're suffering less than what you deserve anyways, Job. And this is the way that I used to think about the book. I used to think, oh, if Job only knew what he deserved in hell, he would thank God that he wasn't getting what he deserved. And that's actually true. There's a truth to that. But the book denies us that option of explaining the sufferings of Job. We are given at the beginning of the book a commendation by God himself. We are to look at Job as being a God-fearing, evil-turning away, good-affirming, complete, blameless man. Yes, we can understand Job's going to die someday. Yes, we all die because we're all sinners. And the wages of sin is death. Original sin tells us why everybody dies. But it does not tell us why I'm suffering and not my neighbor. That question will not be answered by original sin because my neighbor has just as much original sin as I do. There must be something else going on or else it is arbitrary. And so I have no recourse then in original sin to explain the sufferings of Job any more than the disciples who passed by the man born blind asking Jesus, who sinned, his parents or him? And Jesus said, neither. This has happened for the glory of God. There is suffering in the world that is not tied to the person. And that then leads us then to a further thought. There are more beings in this story than just Job and God. Job feels like the target. Job feels like, God, you must hate me for no reason. You're punishing me and I don't deserve it. But he's unaware of Satan. And Shiland doesn't mention Satan in his introduction or explanation at all in any part of theodicy. But we should be cautious about dismissing Satan away too early. God is not the one testing Job. Satan is. God already knows Job's character. He is showing Job's character to be what he already knows it to be by allowing the accuser to attack Job. And even more than Satan, there's many people in this world. And the sufferings that Job experienced are even now as you and I are conversing on this book, those sufferings are still benefiting people. In other words, it's egotistical and egocentric for me to not think that there are many other people that are going to be involved in benefiting from what happens to me in my life. Now, I'm not saying or minimizing at all the pain involved. I grew up in a household of deep pain due to leukemia striking a young girl. And I understand what it's like to witness it and to see it, its effect on parents, its effect on children, even into a lifetime. I'm not minimizing any pain in saying this. But it is interesting. I am just one little thread in the big tapestry of human history. And if I expect that nothing would happen to me for a reason outside of myself, as if my little thread is isolated from all the other threads, I am being either incredibly naive and short-sighted, or being worse, arrogant and egotistical. We should expect things to happen to us in life that are for bigger purposes and beyond us, as we see here. Is there a reason for Job's suffering? Yes. It happened in the heavenlies. It's not known to Job. And so often for our lives, Ecclesiastes says, our daily lives are not going to be explained to us. We will not be able to ascertain by examining them why this or that is happening. All we would know is what is revealed to us as God has given us parameters. But beyond that, in His Word, but beyond that, we would not know any more than Job. And God doesn't tell Job. And so that leads us then to understanding, what do we mean by suffering having a reason? Well, if there's not a known reason, that doesn't mean there is no reason at all. I think that's obvious. But even further, if there's no reason in me for my suffering, that doesn't imply that there's no reason at all. In other words, the reason for my suffering may be due to something else, to benefit others, some cause outside of myself, but it doesn't mean that there is necessarily a cause in me, or that there even has to be a cause in me for it to be just to feel this pain. The Bible has a name for this. It's called grace. God Himself admits in chapter 2, in telling Satan, and it's interesting that Shineland doesn't bring this up, but God Himself says in chapter 2 that you have incited me to afflict Job for no reason. In the Hebrew, that's chenam. It's related to the Hebrew word chanan, which is to show favor or to be gracious. In other words, it depicts action that is due to my decision alone. I make this decision freely. That's of the essence of a favor. I can't make another person give me a favor or do me a favor. They will do it if they want to do it, even though we say, you owe me one. Favors come gratuitously because they want to be given. That's a grace. And a grace is not on the level of justice. It's not like Job can look at God and say, because there's no reason in me, you then are acting unjustly towards me. Rather, the fact that there's no reason in me means that God is acting without justice or non-justice towards me. He's acting in grace towards me. It's interesting to think of that if God doesn't act due to a reason in me, like I'm causing this to happen because I did so much good, therefore I deserve this, and here comes the good. If God just freely does me good, and it's not related to anything I did to deserve it, maybe I could never deserve it, we wouldn't call that justice, but we wouldn't call it injustice. We would end up calling it grace. But the book of Job teaches that God can freely do us good and also freely do us bad. That's what chapter 2 says. Shall we accept good from God and not accept adversity? In other words, accept it freely? And so this is an interesting fact. the book of Job teaches there's actually, as there is good grace in the world where God just freely does me good, not due to any reason in me, but because he wants to, so also there's freely given bad in the world. Not because of any reason in me, but because he freely wants to. And he'll have other reasons connected to other things for it that make it right, pertaining to his glory. But if I were to look at God and say, well, you can't do that to me. You can't operate freely towards me. Number one is that would be questioning his right to be God. But even if we talk about it on a personal level, I can't have my cake and eat it too. I can't accept, as Job says, a freely given good from God and then deny him the right at times to freely do me harm. I can't have it both ways. It's going to be freely given because God is God. And as I'm thankful for the good things that have come into my life freely because he wanted to, so that teaches me and helps me then to accept the bad things that have come into my life freely because he wants to. It's interesting. It takes time for a person to appreciate this. I asked Brock Lutz once, the counselor at the college, what is it that pastors need to know? You get to talk with the students, you know, quite a bit. And so what do we need to know? And his response was, you need to know this. When bad things happen to them, their typical response is to look up to heaven and say, what did I do? You can see that's our reaction. If there's not a reason in me, we assume there must be no reason. And well, it happens for a reason. So what did I do? Where's the reason in me? And he says, rightly so, that should be questioned. Just because I experience pain in my life doesn't mean that it's punishment. I mean, any athlete, this is me talking, any athlete can tell you that pain doesn't imply punishment. Just because their coach puts them through the ringer doesn't mean that their coach hates them. And so Brock then said, and rightly so, that students should be cautioned to react that way. That's a Job reaction. And they should be introduced to a larger vision about God. And then he cited a book by Jerry Sitzer, who experienced a horrific tragedy and then came to understand it, as the title of his book describes, a grace disguised. And I like the fact that he used the word grace. And Brock pointed out that one of the chapters in the book speaks of the randomness of God. It's not random or arbitrary in the sense that there's no reason at all. But with respect to me, it's random. It comes in out of the blue because it's not attached to me or grounded in a reason in me. And the chapter in the book that Brock cited is called The Terror of Randomness. I think that captures the fear of the Lord then, that the Bible claims is the beginning of wisdom, the beginning of knowledge, and is the basis for our course in the Western theological tradition as we look at God. One final note then, based on just what we've seen today in the book of Job. It's interesting that God doesn't just come to Job in the storm and reprove his self-righteousness, which is the tendency of any victim or any apparent victim where I'm suffering due to no reason in me. We tend to feel justified in our importance and then, as Job did, begin to accuse others and even God. There is real victimhood and there is real oppression, and that's different, but any victim, whether apparent or real, has the tendency and the temptation towards self-righteousness, should be guarded against. But God doesn't just come in the storm. He also then brings Job out and says, can you do this and do you know this? And he uses the science of the day. Not just to show I'm so wise in all that I do. Just look at how wonderfully this works. The ostrich and that wild donkey forsaking the young, I think it is there, shows there's weirdness in the in the natural world. This isn't just a William Paley natural theology of just a God that always does just optimal things that we can self-evidently see. No, in the physical world, there's so much mystery, and we understand that. It's weird. Truth is stranger than fiction. And so God uses all that and says, look, it's so wondrous, and it is so happening. I'm doing the same in your life, Job. If you can't even understand that nor match it in ability, and our science continually reminds us of not only what we know, but what we don't know, then who are you then to claim to be my equal, go toe-to-toe with me, eye-to-eye, and say, I don't know what I'm doing with your life? At that point, we need to acknowledge you're the potter, I'm the clay. You know what you're doing. And start on the basis of the fear of the Lord. Thankfully, can move to trust. It can move even to love. And as Sitzer testifies, even to then the recognition that this has been a grace, though at first it didn't appear to be a grace. As Job is one book in 66 in the Bible, the ultimate fulfillment of the book is in the one suffering righteous man, Jesus Christ, God Himself taking on humanity and then suffering unjustly, and the pain of it described deeply in the Psalms. The Messianic Psalms of Psalm 22, Psalm 69, and others showing its real psychological pain, real human injustice. That God would do that puts the book of Job and the sufferings of Job himself in a whole different context and light. And so the afflictor finally becomes the afflicted. And the one who heard Job cry out, why, finally becomes the one who says, why, on the cross. This is the story that we're going to lead into. It's the story that I hope to explain as the weeks go on. Your next assignment for next class is going to be to write a book review again on the introduction to the book of Job by Raymond Shineland. And so may the Lord bless you in that. I look forward to when we can talk again. Thank you.